You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Okay, good morning. As Sherry said, my name is Carrie Walker, and I'm going to be talking this morning about when big feelings take over, how we can support our explosive children. Here's my kids. I have three kids. My husband Luke and I have been married for 15 years. So our kids are 13, 11, and 7. And there they are with our puppy there. Quite frankly, all four of these individuals have very big emotions. And all struggle with emotional explosions in one way or the other. And to be honest, I think that this is probably the norm, that this is kind of typical of most kids, especially most kids at home, that we are going to see a lot of their emotions. There's the select few kids that are not highly emotional. Those kids are going to have their own problems. But I don't think that's super typical. I think what is more typical is that we're going to see a lot of emotions from our kids. So let's get right into this. You know, as we begin to think about the idea of mental health, emotional strength, or emotional regulation, I don't think we have to think about this very long before we kind of start to ponder this kind of cultural crossroads, I would say, that we are at. You know, a year or two ago, I was teaching here on the topic of mom brain or baby brain. And as I was preparing for that, I was talking to someone of the baby boomer generation, and they said, they were asking me, you know, what's the topic? And I said, mom brain. And they said, yeah, can you explain that to me? Because I've heard that, and we didn't have that when I was having kids. And I thought, okay, yeah, you did have that. You guys just didn't talk about it, right? Or whine about it like we do now. And so when we look at the baby boomers and the generations prior to them, they have a very different perspective on emotions and on mental health, right? If they had an emotional explosion, you know, their parents were likely to say, cut it out, or quit crying, or I'll give you something to cry about, right? And so you fast forward to today, the current generations, the people of the 2000s, 2010s, and we've kind of had this hyper-fixation on emotions and mental health. And, you know, there's been some benefits to that, where we have maybe become a little bit more emotional intelligent than some of the baby boomers and the previous generations. Yet at the same time, we've begun to see some of the downside to this kind of obsession with emotion, where we are in the biggest mental health crisis there ever has been. These generations would be maybe characterized more as emotionally fragile or unstable, whereas the baby boomers are known to be tough, right, and have a lot of grit. And so as we think about this for our kids, it can be really confusing to think about what is emotional health? What is it that we're shooting for? So what is an emotionally strong person? So this morning, I'm going to be referencing almost exclusively this book by David Thomas called Raising Emotionally Strong Boys. And I have to say, this book is excellent. David Thomas is not to be confused with the founder of Wendy's. He is the guy who also wrote Wild Things. Boys is kind of his main topic. He's great. And if you happen to listen to this, he's got a real smooth southern twang. It's a real easy on the ears. I like this book for a number of reasons. Oh, him and Sissy Goff, they're counselors in Nashville. And they have employees that are Labrador Retrievers, which I couldn't love anymore. Anyways, he's got incredible illustrations. This book is just wonderful. But obviously, this book is geared towards boys. We're not going to be focusing on boys this morning. Quite frankly, even though there is a lot of good stuff on boys in this book, I think a lot of what he talks about, we could apply both to boys and girls. So in his book, he really points to Jesus as our model for what is emotional strength and health. And really one of the sweet things that he has in the book, right in the beginning, is he has this description on what a new or healthy perspective of masculinity should be, and it's based on Jesus. And to be honest, it's, I think, incredible. I think it's a beautiful picture of masculinity. But I also would argue that a lot of what he says in it, we could apply also to girls. You know, Jesus is the model for both of us, right? So here's what he says. A foundational part of raising emotionally strong kids includes anchoring them to a clear understanding of the character of Christ and seeing the strength of sacrifice. If we hope to raise kids with relational strength, we need to see a man who walked intimately with a few close friends. As we evaluate his interaction and conversations with the disciples, his closest companions, we see intimacy and vulnerability. We see a man who celebrated and elevated women. We see a man who was constantly challenged and questioned throughout his ministry and somehow never went off the rails. Jesus, in his humanity, was full of emotions. He wept with his dear friend Mary at the loss of her brother, Lazarus. When he encountered tax collectors using the temple for purposes never imagined, he felt anger. In the garden, as he was wrestling with his impending death and his closest friends fell asleep after he'd asked them to stay awake with him, we are told that he felt fear. Our kids will experience every one of those emotions, sadness, anger, fear. Our job is to help them identify what they feel and what to do with those emotions. I think this is an awesome example of what it is we're shooting for, right? That we want our children to feel and understand their emotions. We want them to know what they're feeling, yet we don't want them to be controlled by it, right? And so that is kind of the middle ground that we're shooting for. In his book, he points to Ephesians 4:26 as kind of the goal. In your anger, do not sin. And he kind of points to the fact that, you know, this is acknowledging the fact that we have emotions, that we're going to experience anger, but that we're not going to be controlled by it. So that's the goal. We want our children to be emotional yet controlled. So I always like to start by kind of defining what it is that we're talking about at the beginning of a teaching like this. And so for our purposes this morning, we would need to identify what is an emotional explosion. I think as parents, we probably don't need to define this too much. We're probably all well acquainted with an emotional explosion. This is a picture of a toddler throwing themselves on the floor in a grocery store. It happens a lot in grocery stores for some reason. Screaming, you know, some, especially little boys, will slam their heads against the ground. Toddlers are known for their emotional explosions. The terrible twos, the three-nager. I will say that a lot of the toddler explosions often have to do with a power struggle or their attempt to manipulate or control us. I do sort of want to put that in a separate category than what we're talking about tonight, because I do think that there's a little bit of a different parenting approach to that. There is going to be a little bit of overlap, though, when we're talking about emotional explosions. As our kids get older, I think it can become even more exhausting, more concerning, when we see our kids lose it emotionally. They're bigger. We feel like this is not age appropriate. You are acting so out of character. Often our kids are screaming things at us that we never thought they'd ever say to us. They might be breaking things, slamming doors. It can be very concerning as our kids get older. And this often is in response to any number of things. You might look at your toddler in the wrong way, and that sends them, you know, off the rails. With our school-age kids, it might be that they are struggling with math. And so when they come home from school, they're emotionally overwhelmed. And when they sit down to do their math, they're screaming at people and throwing things and losing it emotionally. It might be a sense of injustice, right? On the playground, during family board game night, where your kid throws Uno across the room because they got skipped. You know, there's any number of things that can set our kids off. I also think it's important for us to acknowledge the fact that there are some kids that their emotional explosion is going to be more inward, that it's going to be more of an inward spiral. It might look more like they are withdrawing or unable to even talk through what they're going through. They might go to their room and refuse to speak to you. And I think this can be equally concerning or more, because we don't know what's going on in their head, right? We don't know how extreme, you know, their thoughts are becoming. So I also thought it would be helpful for us to go through what, just briefly, what's happening physiologically when our kids are emotionally exploding. In Thomas's book, he refers to the emotional explosion as being emotionally stuck, which I think is a great descriptor of it. And he says it's kind of a human dilemma that even some of us experience, being emotionally stuck, that we feel overwhelmed, we don't know what we're feeling, we don't know what to do with our emotions. So today, and this would be kind of a different understanding of what's happening in the brain compared to when the baby boomers were children and when they were parenting. Today, we understand that there are two main areas in the brain that are associated with emotional regulation. And so those two areas would be the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex. So the amygdala is the area in our brain that detects threats and it triggers quick emotional and physical responses. So this is the fight or flight area of our brain, which we need, right? So it's going to raise our heart rate. We're not going to be thinking super clearly. We're just going to be reacting. The prefrontal cortex is the CEO of the brain. It is responsible for planning, decision-making, applying top-down control to calm the amygdala. Okay, so this is how emotional regulation works. They have identified the fact that there can be something called the amygdala hijack, and that's where you're so overwhelmed with emotion that really the brain cuts off communication to the prefrontal cortex, meaning when we are talking to an individual in this state, they are not thinking clearly. It's like talking to a drunk person. They can't reason or calm down. They can't think clearly when they're in this state. Under a low emotional state, the two areas can kind of feed off one another. The prefrontal cortex can calm the amygdala down. So I think that this is helpful for us to understand. The other thing that's extremely important to understand is that both of these structures can develop in their sensitivity, meaning the amygdala can become more hypersensitive and kind of overreact. The prefrontal cortex can also become more developed and will become more developed as they age, but also it can become more developed by learning skills and tools. So two extreme examples of this would be a child who's raised in trauma and abuse and exposed to drugs and alcohol. They might have a more hyperreactive amygdala. A Navy SEAL is going to be someone who has been taught and learned tools and ways to calm their amygdala in a very extreme situation, right? That they can go into a life-threatening scenario thinking calmly, completely focused, keeping their heart rate down. I say this not because we want to raise Navy SEALs necessarily, but because we as parents should understand that we can teach our children skills in order to calm themselves down. And I think that it's a real positive vision, both for us and for our kids, to have that. Okay, so that really is our main point this morning, that emotional explosions, to a large extent, are normal, and that they require parental coaching and practice to master. Emotional explosions, or being emotionally stuck, is normal, and it requires parental coaching to practice and master. So I have to give a qualification here. I know, and I'm sure many of you know, that there are a number of diagnoses that are associated with significant struggle in the area of emotional regulation, right? I understand that. And I don't want to come off this morning as someone who's anti-diagnosis or anti-medication. That's not the case at all. What I do want to kind of argue the case for is that we should have a perspective of this being difficult for some of our kids. And I think in light of kind of this discussion of the cultural crossroads that we are at, I do wonder, it's a little bit controversial, I do wonder if because of this swing, this hyper-focus on emotions and our mental health, I wonder if we are a little too quick to pursue the diagnosis and pursue the medication and have kind of a narrow view on the fact that this is going to be a difficult area for us, specifically as parents, and for some of our kids. Okay, it's gonna be hard. So in David Thomas's book, he uses this illustration talking about our role as parents And he explains, you know, the role that we have in helping our kids with this is much like the role we have in teaching our children how to ride a bike. That we are going to start by co-regulating, you know, being there, teaching them these lessons, doing it with them, hoping that one day they'll be able to do this on their own. Here's what he says. Doing this work with them and alongside them is co-regulation. The journey from co-regulation to regulation is similar to the approach I took when teaching my kids to ride a bike. In the beginning, I was always with them, offering support and help for the unfamiliar parts of learning a big new skill. I would hold the handlebars while they did the pedaling. Then I would hold their backs to help steady them while they pedaled and steered the bike. Eventually, I would run beside them, cheering them on, and then stand at a distance to offer support if needed. When we haven't been on the bike in some time, we can get rusty and need support until we find ourselves back in the rhythm of pedaling and steering. Also, some kids take to it almost immediately and others struggle greatly. I know kids who fling their bikes into a ditch when they fall off, yelling, "I'm never getting on that dumb thing again." Some kids have difficulty keeping the bike balanced. Some kids can't get the start of pedaling or the stop of braking. We have to labor longer with some kids and shorter with others. The same will be true of our kids. Remember that practice makes progress. I think this is an awesome example that, you know, it's okay for us to kind of be alongside our kids as they're learning this. I think it's also a wonderful illustration of the fact that this is going to look different with different kids, right? If you've had multiple kids learn how to ride a bike, you know that some are just going to teach themselves. Some you have to convince to even sit on a bike with training wheels, right? And in the same way, I think we can be kind of concerned when maybe our second born is flying off the handle and acting like a maniac when that didn't happen with our firstborn. And so we feel like surely there's some diagnosis that needs to happen here, right? It can be startling, but there's going to be a wide variety of abilities in this area with different kids. Okay, so before we get into kind of the practical, how do we help them emotionally regulate? I think it's helpful to go through some of these key features of emotional explosions that are from David Thomas's book. And those key features are emotional anchoring, blame and shame, and effortlessness. So emotional anchoring. This is our children's way of saying, "I feel discomfort on the inside. I'd like to tie an anchor around your waist and drag you to the bottom of the ocean with me." We have all probably experienced this. When we are maybe in a room with our kid and they begin to lose it, whatever, they're losing their mind. We've already done what we feel like we need to do, so we decide, "I'm going to move to the kitchen." Within 10 seconds, that little one is going to pick themselves up, walk into the kitchen, throw themselves at your feet, and begin the fit all over again, right? And if you move to another room, it's going to be like a magnet. This kid's going to follow you around. Thomas argues that kids do this more often with moms than with dads, that there is something about moms where they say, "I feel terrible, and I want to make you feel terrible with me," right? And part of this is they want us to regulate for them. They don't want to do the regulation. They want us to do it for them. As they get older, this might look like a kid just pulling us into an argument that lasts an hour, and you're kind of like, "What are we even arguing about?" Right? They just want to anchor their negativity to us. The second is blame and shame. Hopefully, it's clear at this point that there's going to be a lot of applications for us as adults this morning. So a common feature of being emotionally stuck is one's tendency to jump from one of two reactions, blame or shame, in response to a negative event. I wonder if any of us have this response. You know, think about when you're having a hard time or struggling, how often is it that you're like, "Actually, I'm really mad at my husband," or "I'm really mad at this friend." You know, we want to blame somebody for the negative way we feel inside of us. And with our kids, we might see that our kid's going to gravitate towards one or the other. My favorite example of this, and it didn't really dawn on me until I read this book, when my kids were little, they were sledding. And my oldest saw this ramp that some other kids built, and he's like, "I'm doing this ramp. And I really want you to get a slow-mo video of me hitting this ramp." He was little, though. So I'm like, okay, so I go down to the bottom of the hill. He's waiting in line for his turn. There's all these bigger kids going down. finally it's his turn. He's like, are you ready? And, you know, slow-mo. And I'm like, okay. And so he's hyped and he goes down and misses the ramp. And this, I have it on slow-mo video. The second he misses the ramp, he starts screaming at me, Mom! Ah! And he's so mad at me. And I just started laughing because I was, which is not good advice in helping your kid emotionally regulate. But it seems so absurd that he was blaming me for missing the ramp. I was 20 feet away from him. But this is the natural human tendency, that we want to blame somebody, or we might spiral into, you know, this dark period of shame, right? And so with our kids, it might look like, you know, this math thing, I am the dumbest kid in the entire school. I'm never going to get good at this. I might as well just quit. I'm not even going to try. I'm so stupid. Or I always lose my temper, and I'm never going to get control of this, and I'm a terrible person. You know, we've seen our kids do the blame thing, right? I wouldn't have punched him if he wouldn't have looked at me that way. How am I supposed to, how dare you even talk to me about consequences when he's doing this other thing? My teacher is the problem. I have the worst teacher in the whole world, and quite frankly, the teacher's giving me harder homework than everybody else, right? What we want to do is have our kids get in the middle of this and get ownership. This is the key to emotional regulation and getting unstuck emotionally. What can we own in this situation? And it's interesting that one of the main keys to getting emotionally unstuck also happens to be really the key to a relationship with God, right? This is kind of the central message of the Bible. 1 John 1:9 says, if we confess our sins, he is faithful and just and will forgive us our sins and purify us from all unrighteousness. Romans 5:1-2 says, therefore, since we have been justified through faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. The message of the Bible is that all God expects or asks of us is ownership, is acknowledging the fact that we need help and we want Jesus' death to apply to us. And then we're told we have access to this peace that transcends all understanding, right? This is what we want. When we are emotionally stuck, when we're feeling terrible, peace is what we want. And this is what God has to offer us. And so this is, I think, a advantage for us as Christian parents that we can kind of work this into trying to get our kids into the middle of ownership. Okay, the last key feature here of emotional explosions is effortlessness. I really like this theme that he has in his book. He really emphasizes the fact that emotionally exploding is effortless, right? And emotional regulation is hard work. It's hard work for us as adults, and it's hard work for our children. They're not going to want to do this. You know what feels good? Exploding. When you feel bad, it feels incredible to scream at somebody or to slam your bedroom door. That's what feels good. There's something in us that kind of likes feeling bad, right? And so we as parents need to understand this is going to be hard work for our children. It's also going to be hard work for us. Like I was saying in the beginning, we probably need to have a perspective that this is going to be exhausting. This is going to be kind of a long-term endeavor that we have with our children. It's going to be hard. And it's that tricky kind of hard work that's really internal, right? That people aren't going to see the hard work that we're doing. Okay, so application. How do we pursue emotional regulation? In Raising Emotionally Strong Boys, David Thomas emphasizes this three-step process of recognize, regulate, and repair. So we'll go through each one of these. Recognize. In recognize, there's an emphasis on the idea of teaching our children emotional vocabulary. And I think this has been emphasized in a number of these parenting meetings that, you know, any teacher and counselor these days has, you know, the emotions chart up. And there's something too, being able just to identify what it is I'm feeling that will help kind of diffuse the emotional charge that's going on within us. The great Fred Rogers once said, "Anything that's human is mentionable, and anything that is mentionable can be manageable." When we talk about our feelings, they become less overwhelming, less upsetting, and less scary. This is really true. Often when we can identify and help our children know what it is they're feeling, there is a relief that they feel, and it can be really powerful. So you can look up online. There's all sorts of things you can find, charts and ways that you can kind of teach this to your children, a wide variety of feelings and putting names to emotions. I think it's important to understand this is not a prescription for taking a emotional temperature, you know, 85 times a day. I don't think that's probably beneficial. But we do want them to understand, you know, the variety of feelings that they could be feeling. Okay. Recognize also means that we want our kids to be able to recognize signs and signals. So this is, you know, our body's way of telling us, I'm becoming emotionally overwhelmed or emotionally activated. This might be things such as a racing heart, a stomach ache, sweaty palms, just feeling tense. We can point these out to our kids. I think a part of this, too, is the idea of going through triggers with our kids. You know, this is kind of a pop culture word. I actually really like this concept. Not as an excuse to avoid all triggers or put demands on people to never talk about things that trigger me, but rather for us to help understand what are the things that make me emotional for seemingly no reason at all, right? So for our kids, it might be injustice, a sense of injustice. It might be a transition. You know, I've noticed, Jimmy, that every time I say it's time for bed or it's time to get ready for school or it's time to turn off the TV, you completely lose control. Let's talk about this, right? We can go through what are the things that make you lose your mind, essentially, and how can we address those things? All right. And then my favorite is perspective. So in perspective, Thomas says that we want our kids to be able to categorize the events of life accurately. Okay, so this would be differentiating between life stressors. The event of losing your homework is not going to elicit or should not elicit the same emotional response as losing a loved one. Right? So again, you can go online and they have all these tools and charts where you can have your child go through, here are some different stressors. What would you say is a 1 on a scale of 1 to 10? What would be a 10? Getting hit by a car? Yeah, I would say it's appropriate to completely freak out, scream, get mad, whatever you want to do if you get hit by a car. Your pencil breaking when you're doing homework, I don't think that's a 9. Let's talk through, you know, what is an appropriate response for different stressors. The other thing that he says that I think was really insightful is that we as parents want to normalize negative emotions and suffering, and that part of this cultural swing, once again, has been a lack of perspective on the fact that life is going to have suffering and that there's a lot of things in life that we can expect, and it's going to be hard, but we should expect to happen. Here's what he says. Developing toward this milestone feels as important as ever. In this day and age, kids and teens are using bigger and bigger words to articulate their experience. I rarely hear people say, "I feel sad." They say, "I feel depressed." They don't say, "I feel worried." They say, "I have anxiety." Some do, many do not. In the past, if kids felt really angry with their parents and wanted to get their attention, they might say, "I'm running away from home." I almost never hear a parent report a kid saying that anymore. Kids now say, "I'm going to kill myself," or "I should just die." You know, I think this is right on, right? If a kid's feeling awkward in a conversation, they might jump to the fact, "I have social anxiety," right? As parents, we can normalize the fact that, honestly, I feel awkward when I talk to people, especially people I don't know, or especially to someone who's acting weird. You know, we can talk about how I feel nervous before a doctor's appointment, right? That doesn't mean you have anxiety. That's normal. And so we want to normalize difficulty. When your kid comes home and is losing their mind over a conflict they had at school, we don't respond with saying this is a toxic relationship. As parents, we want to respond by, oh, this is so hard. And I have a lot of conflict in a lot of my relationships, and this is a big part of relationships, right? We want to normalize the hardship. We see this in the Bible as well. John 16 says, in this world you will have trouble. Romans 5 says, not only so, but we also glory in our sufferings, because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope. As Christian parents, we can look at our kids' suffering, and even though it's difficult, we can know that, you know, there's going to be some value to the hardships that they endure, especially in childhood. Okay, recognize. The second step is regulate. One of the big emphasis that he has in his book is this idea of the space. So he advocates that as parents, we should have a literal physical space in our house that's used for when our kid is emotionally exploding. And so this is going to be a separate area from the family, maybe their bedroom, maybe the basement, maybe the garage, where they can go to do their exploding, okay? And so obviously when they're young and when we're beginning this process, we're not just going to send them. Often we might go with them, or we might hold their hand, or we might have to carry them to the space, and we might do the regulating activity with them. But it's to teach them that we're not going to allow for explosions. This is not how we work out our feelings. You got to learn to have this habit of going to deal with your emotions eventually on your own. And so one of the big emphasis in his book is that boys have a lot of physicality to their emotions. He talks about that quite a bit. And so for the space for boys, he advocates for something they can do to get their aggression out, a punching bag, a mini trampoline. You know, I think that we could probably have the space be figurative. You know, maybe it's a run around the block, or you're going to go to the park and shoot hoops. You're going to shoot 20 baskets, whatever it is, something physical where they can get that out. For some of our kids, it might be an area they can listen to music. They can do crafts. They can rock in a rocking chair, whatever the case is. But we want to have this as a practice that's happening on a regular basis so that we have a common response. Okay, it seems like you're starting to get upset. Go to the space. Tips and tricks. So in his book, he has a number of tips and tricks. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this either. It's super interesting. If you have a kid that gets extremely overwhelmed and, you know, really emotional, one of my kids has had significant struggle in this area, and as we began to look into some of the physiological hacks, it's fascinating. You know, there's like ice pack on the face or the chest. It can calm the amygdala down. There's all sorts of tips you can find online. Combat breathing is a big one that Thomas emphasizes. He says that it's helpful to have a kid wear a heart rate watch so that they can physically watch their heart rate go down and know, I have control over this. And it's, I think, really empowering in a lot of ways. Okay. Physical activity. When I'm teaching, I know that I typically am drawn towards sports and exercise illustrations. And normally I try to, you know, kind of hold back a little bit because I know that I'm biased in that area. I've always been into sports. I studied physical activity in college. But, you know, this morning I just decided I'm going to let it rip. Because who else will do it? And I also feel so strongly about the value of physical activity and exercise, specifically in the area of emotional regulation. So, physical activity. I think most of us know that rhythmic movement is calming to the nervous system. This is one of those physiological hacks, right? That's why we rock our babies. It calms us down and it calms them down. So that also would include walking, biking, rocking in a rocking chair, dancing, swinging on a swing. All of these things are going to calm the nervous system. Exercise is even more profound when we're talking about emotional health and emotional regulation. Exercise enhances the prefrontal cortex. Remember, this is the area we want to develop in order to have emotional regulation through the release of growth factors such as BDNF. Doesn't really matter how, but it does do that. It causes an increase in mood-lifting endorphins, so serotonin and dopamine, causing feelings of well-being. This is the generic term they use to describe the runner's high, right? So we're talking about prolonged cardiovascular exercise. It is going to act like a drug in our brains and in our children's brains. It causes the feelings of well-being, and it reduces stress hormones in our brain. Think about this. Think about if we can teach this habit to our children, what a gift this would be. You know, many of us know that anytime we were to go to a primary care physician and report issues with any kind of mental health issue, depression, anxiety, whatever, they will always first ask about exercise and always first prescribe exercise. Exercise is so profound in the area of emotional regulation and emotional health. Imagine if we were to teach our children a habit of when you're emotionally overwhelmed, you go for a run. What a gift that would be that they could grow up as adults to have this healthy habit. That instead of reaching for something that's going to numb them, like a screen, or alcohol, or drugs, or whatever it is, that they have this healthy habit built in. Exercise also improves attention, focus, memory, and problem-solving skills, helping you to stay calm and to think more clearly. And so for a lot of our kids, especially boys, but a lot, I would say girls included, part of the space or this habit of calming down, I would say, should include exercise. They go for a run or a walk, or they do, you know, they punch the punching bag. It's a stress reliever, allowing for the physical processing of tension and promoting relaxation. So the physical processing of tension would be, you know, a lot of us get tense in their neck or back. You know, we just feel kind of bad when we're stressed out. Exercise is going to relieve that. On to sports. Okay, again, I understand I'm biased toward this area. I understand it might not be for everybody, but I also think, especially for people who didn't grow up playing sports or maybe haven't been exposed to it, this is something that is not talked about enough, in my opinion. Sports increases self-esteem and confidence in children, organized sports. This is through achieving fitness goals and overcoming adversity and failure. I could talk about this single topic for an hour, probably. One of the things I think is so beneficial to sports is our children being exposed to, on a regular basis, this thing they don't feel like doing, but then they go do it and they feel happy that they did it, right? And so even the most sports-loving kid often is going to be like, I don't want to go to soccer practice. Then they go do it, and they get hit with all these endorphins, and they have fun, and then they realize, oh, I'm actually really glad I did that. How many things in life is this going to benefit? How many things in life do we not feel like doing, but actually it's really good for us to do? They also are going to experience the feeling of their brain telling them, I cannot do anymore. You know, if you're on a sports team, hopefully you get to experience conditioning. David Thomas actually is real biased towards distance running, and he talks at length about it. Specifically for this reason, he talks about, you know, the limiting factor in cardiovascular endurance is our mind most of the time. And so our mind's going to tell us, you have to stop, we're going to die, you can't go anymore, when we can actually do quite a bit more. And so our children are going to experience that feeling. And again, this is going to benefit them when they're feeling like, I can't handle anymore, I'm feeling so overwhelmed, I have to scream, right? They're going to learn, actually, I know how to tell my brain I can do more. And I know that my brain doesn't always tell me the truth. Overcoming failure, public failure, I think is an extreme benefit to our children. They're going to experience regular frustration. They're going to experience injustice. They're going to have a coach who treats them wrong. They're going to have a ref that calls the wrong thing. Regular exposure to these difficult things that are going to help them develop and kind of work out this muscle of emotional regulation. It provides stronger social skills and teamwork, better stress and anxiety management. There have been found to be significant academic and cognitive benefits to organized sports. I realize there are, you know, other difficulties when navigating organized sports and how much and whatever. I do think it's helpful for us to understand the benefits that some of our kids' particular personalities will probably gain from being a part of an organized sports team. Okay, last one is repair. This is going to be the key to ownership. So we have recognize, regulate, and repair. Repair is going to happen after the explosion, okay? And I think this is going to be the hardest one for us as parents. You know, when we make it through an emotional explosion, we can just feel like, oh my God, thank God that's over. We made it. For some of our kids, it might last an hour, 2 hours. It might often be at the end of the night, they cry themselves to sleep, and we're just like, oh my God, thank you that I'm done dealing with this. But as parents, we need to decide, I'm going to go back in and poke this tiger and bring this issue back up with this person, because we have to talk through what just happened. When they are calm and regulated, this is going to be when they're thinking clearly and they can process what they need to process after, you know, whatever sin it is they've committed in their explosion. So during this time, they're going to do relational repair. You know, they screamed, I hate you, or, you know, they said something mean to a sibling. This is going to be the time for them to practice unqualified apologies, which sometimes requires a lot of hand-holding, and no, you're not sorry that he made you hit them. Let's talk about that again. You know, this is going to be how they understand ownership. This is also going to be the time where they can, or we as parents, are going to practice discipline. This is a topic that Thomas doesn't talk a ton about in his book. He does have a podcast that I listen to, so I don't think that he's anti-discipline. It's just not a focus in his book. He does say, though, that discipline needs to happen not during the explosion. This is going to be where discipline's most effective, right? Because they're thinking clearly. So we can practice positive reinforcement as well as negative reinforcement during this time, right? That if you have a kid that you're trying to get to go to the space, they screamed, had a couple other offenses, but they for the first time went to the space to calm themselves down, we're probably going to celebrate that and reward that in some way. We probably need to have certain boundaries that when this is crossed, no matter what, even if you're sorry or you didn't mean to, there's going to be a consequence for this. This is going to be the thing to motivate our children to pursue emotional regulation, right? If there's no consequences for their wild behavior, why would they want to pursue the hard work of regulating? Okay, lastly, in his book, he has a number of habits and practices that we can utilize just to pursue a healthy mind. And one of the things I thought was so interesting and kind of profound was this chart that he included. It's called the Healthy Mind Platter. I had never heard of this before, and I think it's such a valuable tool, probably even for us moms. This is a chart that was developed by two clinical professors, I think at UCLA, and it's kind of a play off of the My Plate, which is based off of the pyramid, food pyramid. So like the food pyramid that, you know, says we need to have a wide variety of nutrients to be healthy, these guys say that our minds need to have this wide variety of activities to be able to be in a healthy state. And so one of the things that Thomas talks about in his book is that if you ask any boy, what do you want for your summer? They all will say, I don't want any responsibilities. I want to stay up late. I want to sleep in, and I want to play video games as much as I want. He says it's clockwork. Every boy's going to say that. And he says, that's good, and it's fine. But they don't know what they need to have a healthy mind. And I wonder if some of us don't know what we need to have a healthy mind, right? So this has seven areas on it. Sleep time, physical time, downtime. So downtime would just be like relaxing. Focus time, that would be a time where our brain is focusing, like reading a book or doing a puzzle. Play time, time in, this would be a time of reflection, maybe journaling, maybe for some of us this would be our time spent with God. And then most significantly, connection time or connecting time. This would be relational, face-to-face time. And it seems, I think, in the last 10 years or so that science has kind of caught up with the Bible in acknowledging the need that we have to be in relationship. And my favorite part of Thomas's book is his heavy emphasis on relationships. It is extremely rare to read any book or hear anyone talk about mental health or emotions and include this need for relationships. It's also very biblical. It is backwards to what we think for ourselves. In it, he talks about this guy, Eliud Kipchoge. And he, again, admits that he loves distance running. Eliud Kipchoge is one of the most famous marathon runners there has ever been. He is from Kenya. He is the first guy to run a sub-2-hour marathon. And so that's a 4-minute, 38-second mile for 26.2 miles. Good or no? Prior to him doing this, they thought it was physically impossible. And so the significant thing about Eliud is the way he did this. He employed a team of pace setters, and these guys would run in front of, next to, and behind him. They would, you know, decrease the wind resistance. The guys next to him and behind him could hear him breathing. They could give him real-time feedback on his gait and foot strike. You know, they're seeing everything, and these guys would sub out for each other throughout the race. David Thomas says, if you watch the time that he breaks the record on YouTube, it is the most moving event in all of sport. Remember, he's biased. But he says this because you get to see the pace setters separate, fall behind, and allow Eliud to cross the finish line. And the point he makes is for our children and the need for relationship, close relationship with other people. And he says, you know, the truth is life is difficult, and it's almost as difficult as this like impossible feat of running a sub-2-hour marathon. And we need to teach our children, we need real relationship, that our children are moving to more and more digital relationships, social media and video game interactions. But we need people face-to-face with us, hearing us breathe, you know, picking up on the nonverbals. And so he says that we need to show this video to our children and say, who are the pace setters in your life? And more importantly, who are you a pace setter for? And the fact that he wraps this up into emotional health, I think, is so profound. You know, our culture's obsession with emotional health and emotions is an obsession with self. And what the Bible tells us and what David Thomas is pointing out is that emotional health is going to be best when we are focused on others. Just like we see in the Bible. You know, John 13 says, a new commandment I give to you, love one another as I have loved you, so you must love one another. Matthew 16, for whoever wants to save their life will lose it, and whoever loses their life for my sake will find it. 1 Corinthians 10, no one should seek their own good but the good of others. Okay, that's it. Recognize, regulate, and repair. God, thank you for children. Thank you that we get to be parents, and thank you for your grace towards us. I think probably most of us in this room feel like we have not figured this out for ourselves perfectly, but thank you that you're gracious with us. Help us to be gracious parents and to really gain your perspective on this issue of emotional strength. We pray for our children that they would grow up to be emotionally strong. Followers of you. Amen.